Aloha and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vanderbilt.
And I'm Catherine Cruz.
When private insurance didn't want to cover homes in Kilauea's East Rift Zone, the government stepped in. We'll look at the impact of the Hawaii Property Insurance Association.
And where have all the lifeguards gone? Summer's underway in a time when city and county pools should be extending their hours, some are cutting back. And Maui College sets its sights on a lofty goal, what one administrator calls a Star Trek deal.
A casual encounter in wartime Honolulu turns into something more in the film The Last Taxi Dance. It's Monday, June 18th. The conversation starts right after headline news. Now that hundreds of homes have been destroyed by Kilauea volcano in the last couple of months, some are asking how people were able to purchase and insure homes in such a known high-risk area. Kili'i Akina is the president and CEO of the Grassroot Institute of Hawaii. Earlier this morning, we spoke about the government-backed insurance program, the Hawaii Property Insurance Association, that made many of those home purchases possible. We began by looking at the background to the 1991 measure that created the HPIA.
Well, basically, the government made it possible for us to defy common sense. In other words, if we looked at what was really going on, dangerous lava flows, a history of destruction, the unwillingness of insurance companies to insure, nobody would have been able to get insurance and build homes in dangerous locations. The government said, forget about that. We're going to require all insurance companies to be part of a nonprofit group that's going to guarantee that anyone who wants to build a home gets to build a home.
What was the stated intention of government in creating? This is 1991?
Back in the 1990s, we saw something quite tragic take place in the engulfing of the town of Kalapana with lava. And at that time, the insurance companies suffered massive losses financially, not to mention the losses to the homeowners and the residents of the area.
Right.
At that time, insurance companies were just without the ability to provide further insurance. So our government passed a law. Our legislature went to work, and they said people deserve the right to get insurance to build in the dangerous lava zones. Yeah. And so they created an organization called the Hawaii Property Insurance Association. It's a nonprofit group. And all of the insurance companies that want to do business in Hawaii have to be part of it, and they pool their resources and underwrite the losses. The law itself allowed people to build and buy homes in lava zones 1 and 2, which are along the ridge and between the actual volcano and the ocean on the southwest side of the island. There was a history of ongoing lava activity there, and basically that was ignored. The insurance now made it possible for people to purchase homes and have them insured, where otherwise the market itself wouldn't have made that possible. It resulted in an incentive to get out there and build homes on cheap land. I think you may remember back then the Honolulu Star Bulletin. I have an interesting little ad there for Leilani Estates. They ran an ad for $100 lots out there. And so that looked like a very enticing incentive to go out and build on a $100 lot, Leilani Estates. But nobody would be able to do that unless the state came in and said, here's your insurance.
$100 down gets you a home in the East Rift Zone.
That's right.
Well, when a law like the one you're talking about, it's a 1991 law, right? The establishment of this nonprofit.
Right, what we call the HPIA.
When something like the HPIA is created, it's done with benign intentions, or at least stated as having benign intentions. What were the intentions of the law?
Well,
equal opportunity, you know.
A vague sense of fairness, that if somebody wants to own a home, they should have the right to be able to buy a home that they can get insurance for. But this is a mistaken notion. Nobody is denying anyone the right to build a home in a dangerous lava zone. What we're talking about here is whether insurance companies should be forced to insure them. Now, if you have the means to pay very expensive insurance, for example, Lloyd's of London will be glad to insure your space shuttle.
If you weren't willing to pay enough.
That's right. So that's not what's being denied. But what's happening here is the government is saying everybody has a right to that insurance, therefore we're going to make sure that you can get that at a cost that's affordable. But there are other costs as well. You see, when you override the market mechanisms and you build homes in the lava zones and then the homes are destroyed, it's not just the homeowner who suffers. It's not just the people living there. It's also the neighborhood, the community, and more than that, it's the emergency workers that come in from city and county and from the state and the countless numbers of volunteers. It's the lives of others in society that are endangered as well.
With over 500 homes destroyed to date by the latest Kilauea eruption, can we anticipate the overall cost to Hawaii Island, to the state?
Oh, the costs are tremendous. I mean, Chris,
it's a ripple effect, right?
That's right. As you know, about 533 homes have been destroyed as of today, and we don't see any stopping immediately of the lava flows. So that figure is going to go up. The human tragedy is great, and beyond that, the value of those homes is approximately, $116 million. But that doesn't count surrounding property, and it doesn't count how much society is paying. For example, the emergency workers, and this is something people may not realize immediately, the city and county and the state emergency workers have to go into massive overtime. Their pensions are related to their overtime pay. And as a result, the head of the emergency or the head of the employee retirement system has said, we're facing a situation like a major drop in the stock market that's going to impact what taxpayers have to pay into the employee retirement system. And that is just part of the cost. There's the other cost, of course, and that is the amount of money that the insurance company is going to have to raise in order to cover the losses. That's going to be passed on through a hidden tax to consumers, to every property owner in the state.
Hidden how?
In that there's no law that says the taxpayers have to underwrite the insurance losses, but you and I know the insurance companies to survive are going to have to pass that on in the prices that they charge everybody else in Hawaii for insurance.
Getting back for a second to the ERS, the Employee Retirement System, and the unfunded liability, which is absent this latest situation. What was the unfunded liability before, approximately?
Before
Kilauea, before this latest Kilauea eruption?
Well, going into these current eruptions, the unfunded liabilities in our employee retirement system were approximately $13 billion. Mm-hmm. And that's roughly $200,000 for every man, woman, and child in the state of Hawaii. We have probably one of the highest per capita rates of unfunded liabilities. In other words, our great-grandchildren are going to be paying for the employee retirement of the government workers.
What could this have added to the unfunded liability?
Well, we don't have the figures yet because the numbers are growing tremendously. But because pensions are linked to overtime pay,
people get bumped into a higher pension
absolutely.
Bracket.
So we're going perpetually to be paying the qualified workers a higher pension. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't have any problem with the compensation of these wonderful workers. That's not the issue here. They're risking their lives, and they're serving society. But the bottom line is we have to be aware of what the cost is to everyone.
What could be done in future about something, the issue that you're describing here?
Well, the basic issue is an economic one. When the government made available insurance through this mandated program, the HPIA, it took away the disincentive from people who would otherwise have said, this is too dangerous, it's too costly.
I'd like to build a home in the East Rift Zone,
That's right.
I couldn't handle the insurance costs.
Economics gives disincentives for a good reason. There's a term in economics called moral hazard. A moral hazard takes place when one person takes a risk that they usually wouldn't take because they know somebody else is going to pay for that risk. I mean, there are lots of things that you and I won't do because the risks are too high. But if the risk is taken away, we'll go ahead and we'll do that. And that's precisely what happened here when the government intervened with the market. We're not calling for the government to completely move out of the market space. But what we are saying is we shouldn't defy market indicators. When the insurance companies say this just can't be insured reasonably without great cost to society, we should listen to that.
Would you call for the dissolution of HPIA, repeal of this measure?
We're not putting forth any particular proposals, but we're calling for the legislature to take a good look at this and to examine better ways to pay attention to the market and to stop doing things that actually create incentives for people to take hazardous risks.
Kele'i Akina is the president and CEO of the Grassroot Institute of Hawaii. You can link to his articles about the insurance issue through the Conversations Facebook page. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, what's up with city and county pool hours? But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking of a prominent architect whose iconic works stand out in many of Honolulu's neighborhoods and around the island of Oahu. He designed many buildings in the Spanish colonial and mission revival styles, but a few of his designs employ techniques from the Monterey and Mediterranean revival schools of architecture. Some of his most notable projects include the Agricultural and Forestry Building and the old police station in Chinatown. This architect not only built elaborate estates and government buildings for the public to marvel at, but he also designed many private residences, too. In fact, a number of kahala homes built in the Spanish eclectic style bear his hallmark. This morning, we're looking for this American architect's name. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for The Conversation comes from Matson, in appreciation of HPR's local public affairs programming. Since 1882, working to support Hawaii's economy and communities. Matson.com.
Now that summer's here, a trip to your neighborhood pool might be in order, but we discovered recently that the Palolo Pool is now closed on weekends. Summer's normally a time when hours are extended. A quick check online found that Honolulu isn't the only place cutting services because lifeguards just aren't available. Places across the country are wrestling with reduced hours and are stepping up efforts to recruit to fill the slots. We talked with the city's parks representative, Nathan Sirota, about the problem.
The main thing that dictates the availability of our pools is not only them being fully functioning maintenance-wise, but also to have the staff to make sure that they can operate safely and that we can have good trained lifeguard eyes to make sure that the pools, all the pool users are safe when they use the pools. You know, with our part-time lifeguard positions, there's been a high turnover rate, and it's been difficult getting enough lifeguards to have two at each pool for as many shifts as possible. So really, we've been ramping up our recruiting efforts to try and get as many people interested in doing those part-time lifeguard positions. The main thing that we tell them is if they are interested in being a part-time lifeguard to call the pool that's closest to them. That individual pool may not have any availability at that time, but they're being instructed to pass along that information to the other pools as well. So we can try and get anyone interested into some area of employment helping us with our lifeguarding shortage.
So last summer, I know we had a number of pools in the East Honolulu district down for repairs.
Mm-hmm.
I think Palolo, Manoa, and I think it was Makali.
Yes. Manoa and Palolo, unfortunately, did have repairs scheduled at the same time. In that situation, we transferred lifeguards over to Makali, and we asked them to see if they wanted to go to another pool facility to help out with any availability needs that they had. It was, I think, about the beginning of this year, Palolo was unable to secure some of the lifeguards for weekend shifts, and so that's what you had experienced with the weekend closures most recently, is that we were unable to get staff to cover all the weekends, and so we had to adjust our shift accordingly. We are trying to get at least one weekend day covered for Palolo, but again, it's a real struggle to try and keep these part-time lifeguards staffed for our lifeguarding needs.
Right. It is a challenge. At the same time, I know that pool is right across from the Palolo Housing Project, and a lot of kids do go down there for the summer, right, to enjoy their freedom, and then they go over there, and unfortunately the pool's closed.
Yeah, well, you know, we want our park facilities to be as available and open to the public as possible, and definitely for summer there is an increased usage, not only just from regular public usage, but from our summer phone program as well. We try to have that amenity available to the individual programs as much as possible. So really, it's a tough situation when we have to limit scheduling on a facility because of staffing, but it's something that we have to do out of safety precautions.
And so talk about the summer programs and how are we doing that? I know the Manoa one is particularly popular. A lot of folks camp out overnight just to get a space in that program. Are we having to curtail any of those activities?
It is a popular program. Manoa is really the poster child of how popular summer fun is, just because you do get those lines out there, and it really speaks to the quality and the affordability of the program. We do the same kind of thing where we do our best to try and have the staffing to accommodate as much of the kids as possible. I wouldn't say that it's been curtailed by the amount of staffing, but we have to take into account the amount of kids per student, summer fund student aid. So we do have active recruiting for that as well. I think that's actually closed already because the summer fund program actually started last week. But college-level age students, if they're ever interested, it's a really good summer job. It's seasonal, really good pay, above minimum wage. Working with kids, really, it's a good stepping stone for anyone who's getting into child psychology, education, social work, things like that. So, again, the similar call out to anyone interested in joining those positions. But the part-time lifeguards are more of a year-round need as opposed to the summer fund student aides would just be a seasonal hire.
Right. And it was interesting because I did call around to the other counties, and some of them are having challenges filling slots. I think it was Kauai County indicated that one time they were looking at closing towers down because they didn't have enough people to man all the stations. So it's not just Honolulu, not just the city and county, but also even across the country. A lot of cities are facing challenges finding guards, and I guess unemployment is so low. So it really is a big challenge for everybody.
Yeah, you know, and these are enjoyable jobs. You know, there's a lot of benefits really to working as a lifeguard, and it'd be interesting to find out exactly what the correlation is, if you said the low unemployment is having the factor that it is having. But really, it's a good stepping stone to starting a career in the city, working outdoors. The pool users are very friendly, yourself included. You know, people tend to be in a really good mood when they're at the pool, so And for the most part, you know, it's a really fantastic job opportunity and can lead to a lot of has a lot of upward mobility as well working for the city. So we really want to strive those benefits to the jobs because, yeah, it's competitive out there. There's a lot of job availability on every island, and so really getting those qualified workers can be difficult.
So what are you offering for pay for part-time lifeguards?
So for part-time lifeguards, starting July 1st, it's getting bumped up to $14.36 an hour. That's an increase of, I think, about 32 cents. It was $14.04 this month, and it, again, at the beginning of July, it'll get bumped up to that. Flexible hours, it's a part-time job, so it's normally about 19 hours per week, and it's really, you can work. Hopefully, we try to get as many, you know, shifts towards you as possible, but the pool managers do an excellent job of working to your schedule. And a lot of times, some of the immediate closures that we see are due to, you know, people calling in sick and whatnot. So there's a lot of availability if people, you know, if there's a turnover rate or people call in sick, we really do have shifts that open up for different pools. And the more flexibility you have of working at different pools, the more hours that we can get you. And it kind of contributes to being more well-rounded lifeguard as well. If you're working in, you know, just if you're working in one area, you'll get a really good sense of that community there. But if you're working in several areas, you really get a good idea of what lifeguarding is and how it can benefit all these different pools.
Do we have a handle on the certification programs? You know, I think Red Cross usually does a thing, and I know I think Ocean Safety has a junior lifeguard program. You know, I think some high schools offer certification as well. Because, yeah, I would think for a particularly high school student whose water skills are very high that this would really be a plus.
Yeah, actually, we have a really good relationship with Red Cross Hawaii. We, for the past couple of years, they've used our facilities for the certification, and they've actually waived the fees for those certification classes. And that is a requirement for lifeguarding at our pools, is to be Red Cross certified, which is a combination of lifeguarding, first aid, and CPR. Those certification classes run it's about a week. But yeah, it's a fantastic relationship that we have with them. We really encourage not just people who are lifeguarding, but anyone interested in any first responder type of job to take those classes. They're really a benefit. It's good knowledge to have in an emergency situation. But that is one of the requirements for part-time lifeguards. Really, the main requirements are 18 years and older, have to be able to legally work in the United States, and then also be Red Cross lifeguard certified.
Okay. All right. So if you're a lifeguard and want to make some cash, call the city and county. Calling all lifeguards.
Calling all lifeguards. Yeah. And really, the best way, the best route to go to, you know, look for the pools that are near you. But also, if you have the flexibility of working at other pools, because there might not necessarily be a particular availability when you can work. Our website has a tab that's for pool locations, and it has the list of all the pools. So the recreation, it's the ocean recreation sites as well, too. We have three ocean recreation sites, one at Kualoa, one at Ala Moana, and one at Haleiwa. Those also use the same kind of part-time lifeguards as well. Give them a call or even show up and show up to the pool when they're open and see what availability they have. The more people we can get to apply to this and the more eyes we can get on the pools, the more we can keep them open.
Okay. Thanks so much. Nathan Sirota with the City Parks Department.
All right. Thank you, Catherine.
Now, the city's Ocean Safety Division tells us it also has openings, but requirements for beach lifeguards are a bit more rigorous. Its junior lifeguard program is now in its third week. For links about those lifeguard jobs, check out our webpage at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Fresh tales on an old tongue. That's what local storyteller Jeff Gear calls his evening of never-recorded pieces, curated and performed live for HPR's Atherton audiences. Come and enjoy this master of morphing voices and faces, Saturday the 23rd. Reserve your seats today at hprtickets.org. Station members enjoy discounted pricing. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
Local 5, the Hotel Workers Union, is making a big push toward helping its members reach that dream of home ownership. Honolulu Civil Beat reporter Anita Hopschneider has that story in today's Reality Check. Morning, Anita.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So tell us about this. What's this all about?
Yes, so essentially Local 5, Unite Here Local 5 is a union here that represents hospitality workers, and they're starting up collective bargaining this summer, and instead of just asking for raises or typical benefits that you'd expect, they're doing something different. They actually want the hotels to contribute to help workers buy homes by contributing to something called a housing trust fund.
And so where are these trust funds set up?
So they're still working out all of the details, but the idea is to mimic what's happened in Boston and Las Vegas, where unions there have worked with hotels to get them to contribute a certain amount of money every year. And what the unions do is they create a trust fund that the workers can then draw from when they want to buy homes. For example, in Boston, workers can take up to $10,000 in a loan out for closing costs or for their down payment. And you know that can go a long way to helping to make sure that someone achieves their dream of home ownership.
Now, I understand that the interest from the members was very high, that the turnout was really huge.
Yeah, so I went to an event last week, and it was actually with a national nonprofit that partnered with Local 5 to talk to workers about how to obtain mortgages in a low-cost way. And it was completely packed. There were more than 300 people there in this conference room at the Ala Moana Hotel. And the nonprofit's planning to come back in July and do a 5-day workshop. And I was told that workers are planning to fly in from the neighbor islands to attend because people really want to buy homes. And you know, if you're a worker at a Waikiki hotel, the average pay is about $22 per hour, which is more than twice of the minimum wage here. But it's still way less than what you need in order to actually buy a home. And as you know, home prices keep rising here. The median home price in April was $795. And so there's just this huge disconnect between wages and home prices. And hotel workers really want to help bridge that gap and find a way to actually get mortgages, buy homes here in, you know, the islands that they love.
And your article showcased a family that was really struggling with their, you know, just with their daily needs, and they have those dreams of home ownership.
Yes, I talked with one worker in particular who's a housekeeper in Waikiki, and she lives in Mililani. She's 27 years old, but she lives at home. She lives with her parents because it's her parents' home, her boyfriend, her two children, her two brothers, and her sister-in-law. And they all share this four-bedroom home, which is typical. You hear stories about multi-generational families living together in Hawaii, and a big reason is the high cost of living. And so every day for work, she drives an hour and a half to and from Waikiki, and what she'd really like is to be able to buy her own place and, you know, not have to live with her parents anymore, but be able to stay in Hawaii instead of moving away like many of her friends and family have had to do.
Right. Full house. We can all relate to that. All right. Thanks, Anita.
Thank you for having me.
That was reporter Anita Hopschneider with today's Reality Check. To read the full story, visit civilbeat.org. The first container load of solar panels is set to arrive at the Maui College campus in Kahului later this summer. It's part of what's called a net zero plan that some liken to a Star Trek deal that will put Hawaii on the map. During a recent trip to Maui, we thought we would take a closer look at the $6.3 million solar project. It'll be the very first college campus in the country to meet all its energy needs through photovoltaic systems and battery storage. I'm standing in the shade of a solar-covered parking lot. All the electric vehicle charging stations are pretty much all full. It's the sign of the times here at the University of Hawaii Maui College campus. For this first-year Maui College student, the future is only looking brighter.
My name is Evelyn Talvaye. I know that sustainability is very important to our campus. We have a lot of different things to improve our carbon footprint. We have solar panels and we have a recycling center, and we have a lot of programs and activities about sustainability and stuff like that.
And you took a class here about sustainability. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I took Sustainable Science Management. That's what it's called. And it was fun. It was a lot of information that we could use to improve our campus and how we live as people.
Tim Botkin heads up the school's Sustainable Science Management program and has the long view.
Well, as you noticed, the initial investment in the PV work at the carport really gave a big step. That was a 500-kilowatt project, so it's a pretty good-sized investment in itself at that point. And then I think there was kind of a perfect storm. Our local utility, Maui Electric, is, you know, working against trying not to let all of these changes take it down. Frankly, it's tricky. But at the same time, they've been very open to working with us as a campus and with us on these problems. So their receptiveness was a part of it. The financing opportunity and the Johnson Controls taking on this performance contracting as an entity, the vehicle for this, really made it happen in a way that wasn't that difficult, I think, as a decision.
Well, this will make it the first in the country.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so to have that kind of, you know, those bragging rights, I guess, is a big deal.
Well, yeah, it is a big deal. And it's, we like to think we deserve it because, for one, we have the natural resources for it. For two, we have a need to be more sustainable here in Maui and in the islands. And so doing that and showing that we're willing to step out and take these sort of risks is appropriate, I think. So I think that Chancellor did a great job, and the others, Stuart Zinner, as our energy coordinator, did a nice job, and JCI has done a good job. So it's a good team effort.
Share with us what the project will look like. You hope to get some of the PV panels by the summer.
Yes. The first batch should be coming in by the end of the summer physically. And this will be a progressive installation. It's going to take a while because it will cover, you know, all corners of the campus in many ways, those areas that are not being used, including some additional rooftop, but then quite a bit of on-the-ground installation, too, with the notable exception, and this was an important thing raised, is that we want to be sure that if and as new buildings are built, those on the ground can be moved up to the building so that we don't take up land space just for the purpose of PV panels.
Right. But for the current structure of the campus, those buildings, some of those won't get panels?
Correct. The our larger steep-pitched, roof-pitched buildings that have clay tiles, it was determined would just be too tricky to try to install on at this point. So we're not going to install on those. We'll be looking for flatter, smaller roofs where we can and tie them together.
All right. So mainly on the ground. As we currently see in the parking lot there at Maui Community College, or Maui College, I should say. But what does this mean then for the college just as far as sustainability?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I don't think it's coincidental either. I am the coordinator for the Sustainable Science Management Program, which is a four-year degree program. That's the only sustainability degree program and certainly the only four-year program in the UH system. And so we're constantly pushing and working and researching in these fields to try to make sure we do make progress on these areas of sustainability as we know it. And, you know, that includes investing in or even divesting in things, some of those things that get in the way of our being more effective and looking at a brighter long term. So it's our students get involved in these things, and they've had some to say. And again, it's been a team effort on the campus, but I think that our role is one that the whole campus kind of appreciates, that we do have to be leaders in sustainability right across the state.
Right, you want to walk the talk.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, there's no way to ask somebody else to stick their neck out and invest and do something differently unless you're willing to do it yourself, and I think that's something we all have to pay attention to.
So you want to be the green jewel in the University of Hawaii's crown.
Well, I even flinch, frankly, at the term green, because sometimes green is and sometimes green isn't. It really is about making sure that what we're doing will still be good in 20, 30, 40 years, and that we haven't degraded our landscape so badly that we're no longer able to function with the kind of lifestyle and community that we have.
Well, if this is then, though, a big milestone, what do you see is lacking?
Well, we have to pay attention not to the fact that we're taking the step now. It's all good. Just there's no question. It's all good. But we have to pay attention to what this leads to as we go down the road. PV panels, batteries, are advanced technology today. But at the same time, we're beginning to understand as we mass produce them that they only have a certain lifespan, for example, and at the end of their lifespan, they will need to go somewhere to die. And right now, recycling of these things is very much in its infancy and only being done in one place in Europe as we've been able to understand it so far. So we need to look out on the horizon in 20 years or even less, given the work that these panels do in Hawaii, and decide what's going to happen to them when they die. And if there are 100,000 or a million panels in the state of Hawaii, what are we going to do to make sure it doesn't become another landfill problem, for example, that we just deferred by virtue of using the panels? So we have to continue to push for what are the right answers and how to make it better, even as we take these steps.
Right, and there was some discussion, I know, within the industry about, do we have a fee, upfront fee, to be able to deal with disposal costs down the road, like we do with electronics and all of that, just to keep them out of the landfill since we have so little of that space.
Right. Well, and it's an interesting parallel, actually frightening parallel. We've on the campus have, in addition to the Net Zero Project, we've been working on a what we call our sustainability lens analysis of waste practices and recycling in particular. And as we've analyzed it, we're beginning to understand that the recycling world is kind of falling apart with China stepping back and away from it. Paper, plastics, and electronics in particular are just not having a home right now around the world, and it's very scary. So we have to be cognizant of these limitations as we continue to produce more things. We got to know what we're going to do with them, and that's really a critical part if we're going to use that term sustainability.
Right, so this is a bright spot with the net zero goals and the plan to be generating your own energy campus-wide. But then it's kind of sobering. It's like, okay, this is nice, but what else should we be doing?
Right. Well, the problem with sustainability that gets really frustrating is that you can't just select an area of it, do well on it, and call yourself good. You know, with sustainability, you have to look at everything and make sure you're not messing something else up at the time you're doing something well. And that makes it frustrating. Now, again, with this project, based upon the fact that we are the first, there are so few that are even doing anything, it makes it nothing but a good step. But for us to stay on it as leaders in sustainability, as you mentioned, we have to look at the future and be aware of what's happening and start looking at what else we can do.
Right, and what are the unintended consequences of what we've just done?
Exactly. Well, frankly, we try to say you don't get to use that word anymore. We don't get to say unforeseen, unintended. We've got to figure it out so that those things don't happen. That's really our mantra here at the Sustainable Science Management Program is learning how to foresee those things.
Right. Okay, learning how to walk the talk and
avoid the consequences.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you so much for shedding some light. Obviously, a very good thing for Maui College, but then kind of making us think a little bit deeper.
Yeah. And be careful with the but, I say, because it is a great opportunity. But at the same time, we are collectively, Hawaii should be a leader in this. We're the ones that can think about it and need to think about it. So it's an exciting future.
Maui College at the head of the class.
And we were talking to Maui College's Tim Botkin and the efforts to become the first campus in the country to meet the net zero renewable energy goal. By this time next year, it hopes to be entirely powered by the sun.
Aloha, I'm Vukan Vucic, Emeritus Professor of Transportation Systems Engineering at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. You are listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our very small planet. And we're lucky to have the expertise of Christopher Phillips. Hey, Christopher, good to have you here. What do you have this week?
Hey, Dave, it's good to be back. So this week, stargazers look out for Jupiter in the south just after sunset, as well as Mars rising in the east at around 10 p.m. The moon will be passing through its first quarter phase this week, meaning the skies here in the islands will be still dark enough to spot those faint satellites and meteors overhead.
And how about a weather report on one of our favorite residents of our solar system, Mars? I understand you've got some news.
Yes, the weather on Mars has turned out to be very interesting over these past couple of weeks. The red planet is caught in the grip of a planet-wide dust storm that has covered the entire surface. This storm is the largest since 2007 and one of the most ferocious, with sustained winds of over 60 miles per hour. This, of course, has obscured the surface of the planet from orbiting spacecraft and has caused NASA engineers some concern as to whether the planetary rovers on its surface may survive this extreme weather event.
If one of those things gets knocked over by the wind...
Unfortunately, once it's knocked over, it's going to stay on its back. But luckily, those rovers are quite heavy and low to the ground, so the chances of that are very slim indeed. And this kind of storm dramatically reduces the amount of power that the solar-powered rovers can generate, not only because it blocks out the sun, but also because the dust settles on the solar panels.
So that's one of the real inconveniences of this happening?
It is, especially for Opportunity, which is the sole surviving solar-powered rover. However, Curiosity, its larger cousin, should be okay because it's powered by a nuclear battery.
You would think that the dust could cause some sort of damage to the device itself, getting into little cracks and stuff on it.
It absolutely can. It's like driving your car in the desert here on Earth. It can get everywhere and cause problems. Also, on top of that, Martian dust is actually quite corrosive to metal as well.
Doesn't really have to be waterproof, the rover, huh?
No, Mars is completely arid. In fact, dust storms are pretty much the only type of weather you see on Mars. Mars has dust storms. Jupiter has endless lightning, and the moon Triton has pink nitrogen snow. And on Neptune, it even rains diamonds in the lower atmospheres.
Got to get a spaceship out there, get some of that pink snow and some diamonds. It's Christopher Phillips, another fun Stargazer report. Thank you.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week. And we keep Stargazer on demand at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for Stargazer comes from Urgent Care Hawaii. Walk-in clinics in Pearl City, Kailua, Kapolei, and Waikiki. Providing employers with occupational medicine and workers' compensation services. AmazingUrgentCare.com.
And it's time for the answer to today's backyard quiz. Honolulu's architectural landscape is both rich and varied, with a mishmash of styles and techniques employed all over the city. Some of its most iconic buildings draw from influences across the world. Many are the work of one man. If you've ever been on the McKinley High School campus, you've seen his handiwork in the layout of the campus and in the Spanish colonial revival-styled buildings. While many of his works still stand and serve in their original purpose, Lewis Davis designed a great many theaters on the island that have since been repurposed, yet still bear the flamboyant colonnades, casements, and columns that characterize his work. For example, the new Pa'ava Theater on South King is now an auto parts store, and the new Palama Theater on Waipahu Street nowadays holds congregations and sermons rather than matinees or midnight showings. But perhaps Davis's most famous work, is the private Waimanala residence, now demolished, known as Pahonu, made famous as the location of the Robin Masters estate in the hit television show from the 80s, Magnum P.I. That's today's quiz, if you've got one. And did anybody get it?
No, we actually stumped people on this one. There's no winner. We did get quite a few guesses. It was a very popular quiz. Some people guessed C.W. Dickey, Wemberly, Hartwood, or Ossipoff. But no, that was not the answer. It was Lewis Davis. So if you have a quiz for us, you should send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, providing opportunities for students' summer reading with Achieve 3000 Hawaii Home Access, wishing students, parents, teachers, and administrators an enjoyable summer. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
The Taxi Dance Hall is a relative, relic of an earlier time, a place where lonely men could enjoy a woman's company for a few moments for a small price. In wartime, it filled that function for thousands of GIs who were just passing through at ports of call around the world. The short film The Last Taxi Dance is a period piece set in Second World War era Honolulu, in which a brief and casual encounter at a taxi dance hall becomes something much more. Braden Yoder is its director, and he's with us in our studio. Good morning, Braden.
Good morning, Chris.
What was the germ of your idea for this film?
Well, first, thanks for having me, and I'm a big fan of the show, and we're really excited to be able to bring it out to the community and tell people about it. The germ was about connection, mm-hmm. really, and I started writing it in the December 2015, just as all the sort of presidential election was heating up, and all of the sort of vitriol and the sort of polarization led me to look for a story about connection that we could tell from our history that could be applied to today's times.
Well, let's talk about how a connection was made in a taxi dance hall, because we don't have anything like this anymore. And in some ways, they seem sort of decadent, and in other ways, they seem sort of innocent, don't they?
I think I'd go more towards the innocent side, yeah. I mean, it was something about our history that I'd never known about. And several years ago, I was working on a different historical fiction project, and I came across these things where for 10 cents a dance, a man could dance with a woman, and she would stay with him as long as he had tickets. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, she would taxi from one to the next. It's just an interesting social ritual, a space that I'd never heard of before, and that idea was planted and eventually led to this story.
Women who needed a little extra money, men who needed wanted or needed company.
Yeah, well, it actually started during the plantation era, mm-hmm. before the war, when workers who came over from Asia without wives would come into the city to have that connection and dance with women. Mm-hmm. And many of the ones who did work as taxi dancers had jobs during the daytime as teachers or working at the cannery. So this was their chance to kind of wear a dress and get glammed up and go out and have a good time in a pretty innocent way.
The innocence of the setup leads in the story of your film into something a little more I don't want to say darker, but it gets political.
It does get political. I think that's a good way to put it, because our protagonist is a Native Hawaiian woman who is a singer in the taxi dance hall, and she performs for the GIs but has very mixed feelings about all the demographic changes happening in Honolulu. And after the lights have come on and everybody's left, she's visited by a lone soldier who's returned looking for something. And in their last taxi dance, in their dialogue, it does get heated. We're kind of hiding it in this nice sort of painterly period piece, but there's some hard-hitting ideas there that eventually lead to them learning how to connect and see each other as people.
Justin, you reminded me of this when you talked about hiding ideas within a period piece. Let's hear a little bit of a song that you hear at the opening of the movie, Kalakaua After Hours.
Kalakaua after hours, lipstick lady in the night, see the shadow at her shoulder.
Somehow putting that message, and the lyrics here are by Gavin Dawes, right?
That's correct. By Gavin Dawes, and Stephen Inglis co-wrote it with him.
By framing it in that sort of happy hapa-haole style, it kind of has a subversive quality, right? As the song goes on, it becomes a little bit, you know, refers to some of the sort of the darker aspects of nightlife, right?
It does, and she's singing about vice and some of the changes that are happening that she's not entirely happy with. And the song is performed, sung by Danielle Zalapany, who is our protagonist, actually. She's mm-hmm. she's a singer as well as an actor, and did a fantastic job with it. And we got to work with some fantastic talents on this. We had a heck of a time making this movie.
One of the things that's subversive about it is that you don't expect a performer in a pretty dress with a flower in her hair to be that political
Very true.
And that angry.
Very true. And again, once the lights have come on and the space has changed, now it's the same space, but the lights are on, she takes on a different persona. In fact, she takes on several different personas throughout this whole thing, and she gets to showcase the range of her talent. She's a fantastic actor, and we couldn't be happier with her performance in the film.
As the lights come on, and it's now we're after hours, in the wee hours of the morning, and up comes a GI with, what, one last dance ticket?
He has eight, but yeah.
But it's the idea of a fleeting encounter between strangers.
It is. It is. And she's not entirely happy with him coming back. She sees him more as an occupier and as an invader. And that's when it gets political and gets confrontational.
Does he see himself in that way at all?
No, he doesn't.
And is he surprised by this?
He is. And the journey of the film is really reflected in the journey of the songs from that kind of hop-a-holly number that we had composed for the film, with that subversive sort of message, ending with a Hawaiian traditional Kolana Napua, which is itself subversive in its own way from the 1890s. And the journey of understanding between the two characters is the journey through the music.
And a song can be a very effective way of getting a message across because the music draws you in. And then the lyrics sort of hit you later most of the time with songs, don't they?
Absolutely right. This is more like a symphonic suite with the different songs that we have, moving through different moods and having some great musicians to work with. Alan Akaka, Jeff Peterson, Star Kalahiki does a fantastic job with the last song. We're very happy with all the talents involved.
Where does this journey, this political journey, this encounter between two people take us?
It ends with them learning to see each other as people and not as stereotypes. And I'll leave it at that, but we hope people will come and see the film.
But both he and she have a transformation?
They do. You know, it's a bit of a ho'oponopono and learning how to recognize the trauma in other people by recognizing the faults in yourself and learning to bridge those gaps between two people.
So the singer, in spite of the intensity of her feelings, is not completely intransigent. She's willing to learn.
They both are.
Which probably makes them more interesting as characters, right? That's the difference between a character and a caricature, almost.
Oh, that's well said, definitely. And I think that's what we hope makes it relevant as a historical parable to today's times.
Well, thanks very much for coming in. It really sounds interesting. I look forward to seeing it.
Hope to have you there, Chris.
Braden Yoder is the director of The Last Taxi Dance, which will be screened as part of the Ohina Short Film Showcase on Friday, September 7th. And there will be a premier benefit screening at the Hawaii Theater on August 23rd. We'll keep you posted about that, and you can get details on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Pretty sunsets, sweet kind music, public virtue, private vice. That's the story in Hawaii, why they call it paradise.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Nico's Kailua, featuring lunch, dinner, and Sunday brunch, offering poke bowls, smoked fish, and fresh fish daily at the fish market near Aikahi Shopping Center. NicosKailua.com.
We have to go, but up tomorrow, we'll hear from voices from Hawaii's Korean community. We'll talk about the U.S.-North Korea relationship, Hawaii history, and hopes for One Korea.
And we'll be taking your calls on that program. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave your comments at this number, 808-792-8217. Email is talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. You can post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation.
If you miss any of the show, check our conversation page. Just look under HPR News and Talk for The Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.